Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Jen Marlowe. She's a Seattle-based author slash documentary filmmaker slash playwright and human rights advocate. She's lived and worked in conflict resolution in Jerusalem, Afghanistan, Cyprus, India, Pakistan, and Bosnia-Herzegovina. Her films and books include Darfur Diaries, The Hour of Sunlight, One Family in Gaza, and I'm Troy Davis. We speak today about some of the problems in the U.S. judicial and penal system. So I guess my first question is, let's start with a small one. What's wrong with the U.S. judicial and penal system?
Oh, yes, small question indeed. There's so much that's wrong from the bottom up. And, I mean, if I were just to try to hit some of the main problematic areas, first of all, you know, one of the core concepts of our justice system is supposed to be that everyone receives equal justice under the law. I mean, that phrase is actually engraved on the United States Supreme Court building. In reality, that doesn't happen. There is no such thing as equal justice. People of color receive different justice than Caucasian people. People with poverty, people who are poor, receive far less adequate legal services and far less justice than people with means. So the phrase equal justice under the law, although that's supposed to be a component or a key component of our justice system, doesn't happen at all. Another thing I think is really problematic in our justice system is that it's much more focused on being punitive than on rehabilitation. So rather than a system that's all about ultimately trying to get as many people as possible to be productive members of society, there's so much in our criminal justice system which really seems bent on not only punishing perpetrators, but punishing them in such a way that it almost guarantees recidivism, that it almost guarantees that they will continue to be marginalized in society and have, even after they've done serving whatever time they might have served in prison, their ability to be able to then re-enter society in a way where they can be productive and constructive members of society have so many burdens placed on them that makes that nearly impossible. So I think that's an enormous flaw. And kind of in a larger sense, and I think maybe part of these first two problems feed into the third thing I would say, which is that I think in many ways our criminal justice system is not used in the pursuit of justice so much as in a pursuit for political aims. And I think if you really start to examine the mass incarceration that there is in the United States right now, I mean, the United States, we have a greater number of people in prison, a greater percentage of our population are locked up than any other country in the developing world. And if you look at the war on drugs, so much of that seems to be about political goals rather than actually about keeping society safe, which ultimately should be what a criminal justice system is. Their goals should be about keeping society safe, and it doesn't function that way.
Wow, there's so many directions I want to go with this, and let's keep the keeping society safe thing in the back of our mind for a second. And first place to go, I think, is something I was thinking years ago. In my book, Culture Make-Believe, I started by asking, the book was ended up being 700 pages, and it was supposed to be a 5-page introduction to an encyclopedia of hate groups. And the book kind of exploded because I asked the question, what's a hate group? And when I went to a KKK website, the KKK website said, we're not a hate group, we're a love group because we love whites. And so I was thinking, okay, either the KKK isn't a hate group or we can't trust rhetoric. And the next question is, if you can't trust rhetoric, what do you trust? And then I fell into this huge morass, which turned into a 700-page book, because if you go just by the numbers, the biggest racist segregationist organization in the country is U.S. judicial and penal system, because it's achieved segregation of African-American males on a scale the KKK can only dream of. And it gets really, I mean, what are the numbers on that? It's about 33% of African-American males, this is 10 years ago, 33% of African-American males between the ages of 18 and 35 are under so-called criminal justice supervision. And in some cities like Baltimore, it's over 50%. And, I mean, what would you like to say, if anything, about about the sort of systematic racism that you brought up?
Well, if you know, and I think the numbers that you just quoted, those statistics are, I think, are accurate. I mean, those are the same kinds of numbers that I have come up when I, and of course, it varies, like you said, city to city, and when you're looking at different age groups, the numbers vary. But an enormous percentage of specifically African American males spent some period of time under the criminal justice system. And of course, that's not just the time they spend in prison, but even after they're released, whether it's probation or parole, they're still under criminal justice supervision. And I don't know if you've read, for example, Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. She's got a very interesting analysis of it, which I've been thinking about a lot lately, which is that it's not just, in her analysis, this is not just an unfortunate byproduct of a system that where racism has infiltrated into the system, but that it's actually designed to be that way, that it is, her book, The New Jim Crow, would argue that this is the new system of racial control that has replaced the old Jim Crow of official segregation in all aspects of life, and that it's through the criminal justice system, which really is now has the only legalized form of discrimination. Because people who have been labeled a felon, who have been put in jail, when they come out, all sorts and forms of legalized discrimination they are facing, and that's discrimination in the housing sector, in education sector, in job sector, and it's perfectly legal. It's not perfectly legal because they are black. It's perfectly legal because they have been in prison, and so that is being used as the new form of racial control. So I don't think it's an accident that the war on drugs was waged very specifically on black and brown communities and not on white suburban upper middle class kids whose drug use is equal or maybe even greater than drug use in African American communities. I think I agree with Michelle Alexander that there is an element of this that is meant to have one aspect of society controlled by another based on race.
So can you talk about some of those mechanisms for listeners who don't know about the differential treatment of, or differential laws really on, or, and also differential implementation of laws between people of color and white people in terms of the war on, the so-called war on drugs?
Sure. Well, you know, it's really felt in every level of the system. So, you know, stage one, where is the quote unquote war on drug waged? And like I said a moment ago, you don't have stop and frisk happening, in white middle class neighborhoods. You know, stop and frisk policies are happening in neighborhoods that are largely of black and brown communities. So it's black and brown young men who are being randomly stopped, randomly searched, pulled over in their cars, you know, all in these giant fishing expeditions to try to catch, you know, to try to catch some reason, some pretext to be able to then enter them into this system of racial control, which arguably can be what the criminal justice system is called. So in terms of who is targeted, there's a vast difference between whether you're a 20-year-old white suburban kid versus a 20-year-old African American kid living in an inner city community. So it starts there, and then every step along of the way in terms of what charges the prosecutor decides to press forward with, and how aggressive the prosecutor is. There's a whole lot of discretion in our criminal justice system that is in the hands of the prosecutor. The imbalance of power between the prosecutor and the defense is very stark in a lot of different ways. And so the prosecutor can decide, you know, how many, if he's going to load on charges onto the person being prosecuted with the intention of getting a plea bargain out of them. There's all kinds of ways the prosecutor can manipulate his or her power in order to get a certain end. And then, of course, if there is time served, after that time is served, you're often still under the former control of the criminal justice system, whether that's because you've been paroled or because of probation. So we have, you know, not only the millions of people who are behind bars, but the many millions more who are still under the control of the criminal justice system in one way or the other. And these legalized forms of discrimination often carry on the rest of your life. And this varies state by state, but in many, many states, if you have a felony charge, you're not permitted to vote. I mean, you are completely taken out of the democratic process. And that ranges from a number of years in some states to a lifetime in other states. Your ability to seek public assistance for housing, for education, for food stamps, for all of these things that you think someone getting out of prison would be in a special need of as they're trying to re-enter society and, you know, get themselves going again in the world, you are barred. And again, there's some variation state to state depending on if these are state programs or federal programs, but it's perfectly legal to discriminate someone from being able to receive housing, education, you know, all of those things that you need to be a productive member of society. And so it ushers you into this permanent, it ushers, you know, so many of our black and brown young men are ushered into a permanent status of being an undercast and being permanently pushed to the margins of society. It seems to me that system is not at all about, like I got back to in the beginning, all about trying to promote the safety and well-being of society at large, but trying to intentionally create this undercast and maintain it.
I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense, and I think that's a lot of it. And I think one small factor, too, or maybe it's more than a small factor, is, you know, I used to teach at Pelican Bay State Prison. I taught at both the supermax level and also at the minimum, the ranch, what's called the ranch level, the level one security, minimum security. I taught them too. And sometimes I remember a couple conversations where, especially the level one prisoners would say, you know why we're in here? We're in here for job security for the guards, because, you know, the prison industrial complex is an incredible money-making machine, and you've got to have prisoners in order to feed it. And that ties into the racism and keeping. It's a nice dovetailing from the perspective of those in power to be able to dovetail social control and keeping an underclass along with making money. I mean, it's a win-win situation for those in power in that sense.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with you 100%. The prison industrial complex is a big moneymaker, and you can see more and more states turning to privatized prisons, and they often get, you know, the more money, the more heads they've got. And so there's a lot of powerful interests who are stakeholders and want to see the prison system not only maintain what it is, but expand. They've got powerful interests that where they benefit, the bigger and larger the prison system is. So efforts to dismantle the system and replace it with something that actually works better if we're keeping societal safety as one of our primary goals, and B, is far more compassionate and based really looking at equal justice under the law and implementing that as a philosophy. You know, folks who are working to do that are up against some really powerful stakeholders who want to keep the system exactly as it is or expand it.
Well, I know, you know, like I mentioned Pelican Bay a minute ago, and that's in Del Norte County, the county where I live, and this is a pretty impoverished county, and I am entirely convinced that if you could wave a magic wand over every prisoner who is in the prison up there, and suddenly, you know, the sociopaths would no longer be sociopaths, the drug addicts would no longer be drug addicts, the abusers no longer be, they're all going to be fine and wonderful people now. We have a magic wand that can do that. I guarantee that the county would fight to keep them all in prison simply because, honestly, the economy of this county would collapse if that influx of cash that goes to maintaining the prison were to disappear. And I'm not saying that, you know, I mean, some of my students were sociopaths, and we need to be protected from them, some of them. We can talk about safety in just a moment. But even if you were able to magically turn them all into wonderful, cure them, or whatever word we want to use, the economy of this community is pretty much based on it.
Oh, yeah, and I don't think it's Pelican Bay is alone in that. I think there are small towns across the United States whose economy is based on the local prison. And so, yeah, there's people whose jobs depend on it, and there's people who are getting very wealthy from it. And so, sure, yeah, if we could wave that magic wand, like you said, there would still be a lot of resistance to closing down those prisons.
So let's talk about this. There's one more thing I want to hit before we talk about the safety, which is another concern. It's not merely equal protection under the law, but it's also, who was it? Who's the French philosopher who said that basically there is, the law is equal for everyone because the rich will go to prison for stealing a crust of bread just like the poor will? Which, of course, isn't true, that the rich can steal crust of bread. But the point really is that the rich don't need to steal crust of bread. And the point is really that, you know, I had one student at the prison who said that if he could change one understanding in the culture, it would be the notion of drug dealers in Armani suits, because he was arrested for drug dealing. And he said, honestly, drugs put food on my kids' table, because you try raising two children in Oakland making minimum wage at McDonald's. He said, you can't do it. So he was dealing to put food on the table. And that is, what I'm trying to get at is that the damage that he caused to society is infinitely smaller than the harm caused by Tony Hayward of BP, or Dick Cheney, for that matter, or frackers. And so there is not only the, at the level of implementation, but there's also the fact that laws are made by and for rich people. And, yeah, there are rules. I mean, they do put in rules that do protect people, but for the most part, they criminalize stuff they don't like, and they don't criminalize stuff that they do like that benefits them.
Absolutely. Well, I think there's two really important points that you hit on, and one is who's making the laws and for whose benefit, right? So these laws are made by the wealthy and the powerful and the privileged to protect their privilege and their wealth and their power. And so I think that's one of the very important points that you hit on. And then I think the other point, going back to the phrase equal justice under the law, the problem of lack of equality, of course, doesn't start with the criminal justice system. And when you're talking about, like, the French philosopher you mentioned about the rich will go to jail for stealing a crust of bread the same as the poor will, well, the rich don't need to steal the crust of bread. That lack of equality is found in every single one of our systems. Our education system is far from equal. Job opportunities, both because that's based on education, but also access to be able to get to jobs, also not equal. You know, every single plank that our society or any society is based on, that inequality is found. So yeah, in terms of why are people on the streets selling drugs and what is the reason why that happens? Necessity. It's no accident that, you know, I think it's not a total coincidence that the same time that crack swept through began to sweep through the inner city streets, which was actually after the drug war was quote unquote declared, but that's not long after all the factories got moved out of the inner city. So all of these places that were hubs of manufacturing jobs, those jobs dried up, disappeared, and unemployment was, you know, took a sharp increase. So it's not a coincidence that the timing of that is linked to when the drug problem became so acute in inner cities, and that all of that created this opportunity for the drug war to be able to demonize inner city youth and make people afraid of them, which gave them the political support they needed to begin rounding them up and to begin a program of mass incarceration.
So we've mentioned the word safety a couple times, and you've mentioned the word safety a couple times. Can you talk about prisons in terms of public safety, and both as it is and what would you suggest to make? I mean,
well,
just talk about safety for a minute. I'm not sure how to form it. Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't realize I had interrupted you.
Oh, no. I was just rambling, and the next thing I was going to say is my question is incredibly ill-formed, so please just take it however you want.
My answer might be equally ill-formed, but when I talked about public safety, I talked about it with the idea that in an ideal world, I would wish that our criminal justice system had that as its primary objective, that our objective is to keep society safe. And like I said, there's so many reasons why, when you look at how our system is implemented, what the system is and how it's implemented, it doesn't seem to have society's needs and people's safety as its, certainly not as its first objective, if it's even an objective at all. And if we're talking about structuring a system that is about first and foremost public safety, I think that's it's not just looking at how we would need to change our criminal justice system, but it's all those other things that I mentioned as well, education, access to employment, all of those things are what, healthcare, all of those things, environmental justice, all of that needs to be addressed because it's all connected to public health and to public safety. In terms of looking at the specific piece of the criminal justice system, I think it doesn't keep society safer to sweep away large, to basically lock away into cages mass numbers of people and then to reintroduce them, to unlock those cages some number of years later, giving people incredible burdens to be able to reintegrate in society. If there are people that do need to be removed from society because they are a danger to themselves or to others, and of course there are people who are a danger to themselves or to others, the goal should be, rather than punishment or punishment alone, rehabilitation. The ultimate goal should be to be able to successfully reintroduce as many people as possible to be constructive and productive and healthy members of society. And there's all kinds of models that are out there for how, in other cultures, for how that can happen. There are some really, there's a great issue of Yes Magazine from a couple years back where they're looking at prison issues. And it was really fascinating to read about a lot of different restorative justice models, where the focus on the restorative justice models wasn't on punishment per se, but it was basically on healing what had been broken. If a crime is committed and there is injury, let's look at how to fix that injury. And with that being in the that being what was focused on, all kinds of other pieces fell into place around that, which often led to the person who had caused the injury taking more responsibility for that injury, being involved in the reparation of that injury, and then being far less likely to re-injure. So models are out there in a lot of cultures and a lot of societies that we could draw wisdom from, but I think we've got the very wrong thing at the center of our system if our system is ideally about reducing the injury that happens and preventing re-injuring from happening.
So how... Okay, I don't disagree with what you just said, and I think it's really important. And whenever I think about restorative justice, a concern I have is that I think about how rape victims or rape survivors are so often treated by the whole criminal justice system, and how rapists, only 6% of rapists even spend one night in jail, and how every excuse is made for perpetrators of abuse. And so part of my, I think where I'm going with this is that the criminal justice system in all ways manifests the larger imperatives. I don't think you're disagreeing. I think you're saying this too, that it manifests the larger imperatives of the culture. And when you have a racist culture, you end up with a racist criminal justice system. And when you have a system where the rich do as they please and the poor shift as they must, you end up with a really classist criminal justice supervision system. And when you have a really misogynist system, then you're going to end up with, it's like, I interviewed Judith Herman years ago, and I asked her if rapists generally believe their lies, or general perpetrators of abuse. And she laughed and said, we really have no idea, because the only perpetrators of abuse who ever get caught are either those who are incredibly unlucky or completely incompetent. And so, and so we don't actually know what the, you know, run of the mill perp, what they're thinking. You know, they never get caught, and so they never get studied, as it were. And so I'm all for restorative justice, but do you see where I'm trying to go with this? Can I shut up, or do you want me to say more?
No, well, I think I get what you're saying. I mean, I think what you're saying is that in the model that we already have, when people are victims of sexual violence, be it rape or other forms of sexual violence, that's not treated, that's not honored or treated with a level of import.
And
so the perpetrators of those crimes are often, you know, pay little to no price, and the victims of those crimes are basically, and I'm, tell me if I'm putting words in your mouth, but, you know, are basically left to feel very devalued as people because what happened to them has been so devalued, and their experience has been given such little societal importance. And obviously, so, and correct me if I understood any of that incorrectly, but when I'm talking about restorative justice, the victim and the victim's needs and the victim's experience, I think, needs to be at the center of that. And there's different models of it. So when people talk about restorative justice, it doesn't mean just one thing. It's a concept, but how it's implemented, there's lots and lots of different models throughout many, many different cultures of it. But I think if we just I think it requires a shift in many of our societal values, and it requires a shift in how we value each other as human beings. And as part of that shift, I think it means needing to honor people who have been victimized by sexual assault, and needing to recognize that that is an attack, and that people who have suffered and lived through rape and other forms of sexual assault are victims of violence, the way someone who has lived through a beating or been shot or other things that society recognizes more clearly as unacceptable violence. And so I'm not sure that I'm not sure that restorative justice would take any of that away. I think, again, there's all these different models of restorative justice, but it's putting in the center the harm that was done, and trying to address how to, you know, ways to fix that, or ways to address it. And so the first step of that is recognizing the harm that is done. And it seems that that's where we fall way short as a society when it comes to crimes of sexual violence. We don't recognize them as real crimes, and that's what's criminal.
Okay, I really like what you're saying, and I think, okay, and let me know if you disagree with this, but it seems to me that in some ways, I mean, this is, I think we already have a, that there's, the, and this, in some ways it's just so obvious what I'm going to say now, that there's a two-tier system of justice already in place, which is if you are a member of one of the oppressor classes, chances are you're going to get, at every step of the way in the system, you will get, your level of culpability, et cetera, will get diminished. And if you are a member of an underclass, you're not going to catch those breaks at every step. So if you are a white male senator in Washington, D.C., you can get away with much more. And there will be a form of restorative justice for you, probably, because you will be rehabilitated. You know, you can take $1 billion in bribes, and 2 years later, you know, you're a lobbyist in good standing. And if you're a poor person, you're not going to catch any of those breaks. So there's, I guess all I'm getting at is, it makes me nervous. Restorative justice makes me nervous because, just like everything else, it can end up getting abused by those in power. But the same thing is true for retributive justice. The same thing is true for anything. It's going to get end up abused by those in power within the system.
I hear what you're saying, but I guess I don't see, when I talk about restorative justice, I don't see that as being getting let off the hook.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, I think the key to restorative justice is really addressing the harm that was done and working to repair that harm. And so if Tony Hayward from BP was in a process of restorative justice, it would mean really and truly steps of taking true responsibility for the disaster that happened and taking true responsibility for ensuring that it wouldn't happen again. And that would have to lead to enormous shifts in how power and privilege operated. So sure, would calling something restorative justice and putting it in the hands of the powerful lead to some of the same abuses that we already see? Of course. But if we're talking about true restorative justice, part of that model is about really addressing the harm done and finding ways to heal that. And so it's not just about someone getting the free let out of jail, you know, the let out of jail free card.
Well, that makes perfect sense. Thank you for being so clear on it. And so I guess now I can see two directions to go. One of them would be to talk about Troy Davis specifically in, because you wrote the book, I Am Troy Davis. So talk about his case as much of this applies. Or if you'd rather talk about you've done so much work around the world having to do with conflict resolution, having to do with, you have just there's all this incredible work. So which direction would you like to go?
I'd be happy to go in either direction. It might make more sense to start to talk about I'm Troy Davis and Troy's case because my own entry point into trying to explore what's happening in the criminal justice system here in the U.S. was really sparked and triggered by my involvement with Troy and with his family.
Mm-hmm.
And that led me to an exploration of the death penalty as it's practiced in this country and worldwide. And then that, in many ways, what was revealed to me is that the death penalty is really the sharp edge of what's so broken in our criminal justice system at large. So that might be the more organic flow.
Okay, so let's go that direction. So who was Troy Davis, and what was wrong with the case against him? What was it that brought you into that? What happened? I think we can't
Troy
presume that people
was,
know who he is.
An African American man in Savannah, Georgia, and in 1989 he was arrested for the murder of a white police officer in Savannah, Georgia, whose name was Mark McPhail. And in 1991 Troy was then convicted and sentenced to death. When I first learned about Troy's case, it was years later. It was 2007, and it was after he had just survived his first execution date. Georgia had determined to execute him on July 17th, 2007, and less than 23 hours before that, Troy was given a stay of execution. And I heard his older sister, Martina, speak on the program Democracy Now! About this narrow escape that her brother had had. And she began to talk about her brother's case and a strong case of innocence. And she had been fighting, as she revealed on this interview, she'd been fighting to prove Troy's innocence for years and years. And I got curious about his case. I'd never heard of Troy before. I had never heard about his case. And I began to do some research on it. And there had been a report recently put out by Amnesty International, so I found that report, and then so many of the details in this case were summarized in that report that made it really, really pretty clear to me that a travesty of justice had been done, and that and the more I that started my involvement, and as it went on, I got deeper and more involved, learned much more about the case, and it appeared to me so starkly evident that whether or not someone was going to stand up and say that there was evidence that proved Troy's innocence, there was no way to deny that there was a mountain of evidence that led to doubt about Troy's guilt. At the very least, there was enormous doubt about his guilt and a mountain of evidence that pointed towards his innocence. And seeing how the state of Georgia was still prepared to execute Troy, and Troy ended up surviving two more execution dates before they ultimately succeeded in killing him. But what was so highly disturbing, I think, to people all over the country who followed his case, and there were thousands and thousands of them, I think what was so disturbing was the idea that the state of Georgia, despite all this evidence, was so comfortable proceeding with this decision that had been made back in 1991, and that there was no willingness for them to step back, reexamine, try to assess if a mistake had been one, that there was far more investment in rolling forward than there was in admitting that enormous mistakes may have been made. And what I learned through my involvement in Troy's case is that Troy's case is not the exception. And that's perhaps the most disturbing thing of all. We could hold Troy's case up and say, oh, you know, one in a million times something like this happens, this travesty of justice occurs. That would be one thing. But what was really revealed to me, and I think revealed to a lot of people who followed his case, was that Troy's case was emblematic of something that happens again and again and again. And like you were talking about, racism has a lot to do with who ends up in Troy's position and who doesn't. Classism, economics, has a lot to do with who ends up in Troy's position and who doesn't. And, you know, the death penalty, like I called it the sharp edge because, you know, the punishment is irreversible. And so that's, you know, that puts into much starker relief the problems which are endemic throughout our entire criminal justice system and which Troy's case in many ways is emblematic of.
You know, I'm thinking a couple things. One of them is back about the racism and classism, and this is something I sent you in a note previously, and it's something that I've said for years, and it's always just blown me away, which is two riddles that aren't very funny. The first one is, what do you get when you cross a long drug habit, a quick temper, and a gun? And the answer is two life terms for murder, earliest release date 2026. And that was one of my students at the prison. And the other one is, what do you get when you cross two nation states, a large corporation, 40 tons of poison, at least 8,000 dead human beings? And the answer is retirement with full pay and benefits. And, you know, it's extraordinary to me that, once again, the wealthy can literally get away with murder, and the poor, even if there is a decent chance that the person didn't even do what they were accused of doing, still is quite possibly going to end up paying with their life.
Well, absolutely. And I think in many ways it gets back to what we were discussing earlier, which was who makes the laws and whose benefit are they made for? You know, like, The idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness was an edit, was a rewrite. That phrase was originally life, liberty, and the pursuit of property were inalienable rights. I mean, our entire system was based on documents and laws that were developed by privileged white men who were seeking to maintain and expand their privilege. And so it's horrifying but not surprising to me, the sober truth behind those two riddles that you just shared.
So what is the relationship between your work with Troy Davis and your larger work with what's wrong with the United States penal system and your fabulous work all over the world?
Well, if I were to talk about a connecting thread or a connecting link, I think what ultimately I'm trying to do is use, and whether this is in my writing or my documentary filmmaking, is trying to use my camera or my pen as a platform for people to tell their own stories. And the kinds of stories that I'm looking to try to amplify in those ways are stories of people who are resisting oppression and injustice and marginalization, and their method of resistance is with absolutely awe-inspiring dignity and humanity. Those are, I think that would be the common link of all the places that I've traveled and the people that I've met and the stories that I've tried to help amplify.
So we have about 4 or 5 minutes left. Can you give, okay, I got two questions. First one is, can you give a couple examples of this really dignified and meaningful resistance that you're talking about? And then the next question after that is going to be, what do you want people to do? What do you want them to take away from this interview? What would you like for them to take away and do?
Sure. Well, in terms of some examples, there's so many. One that's just in my brain at the moment is I was in Bahrain about a year and a half ago, and I was filming I was kind of embedded myself with the pro-democracy activists who are fighting for democracy. They're trying democracy, human rights, freedom of speech, all of those things. And there was a boy who we saw get shot in the head with a tear gas canister by the riot police, and it cracked his skull open. And the boy couldn't be taken to a hospital because the hospitalized in Bahrain are militarized. If he was taken to a hospital, he definitely would have been arrested, even at the age of 13, and likely imprisoned for having been even at a demonstration. And so there's these series of underground clinics that are in Bahrain, which are basically just people's apartments that nurses and doctors are kind of on call to be able to try with the scantest supplies to treat these type of injuries. And what was so striking to me were these nurses who were risking their own well-being, because medical professionals in Bahrain have been arrested and tortured for treating injured protesters. And these nurses who, as their form of resistance, were making sure that even at great risk to themselves, that their injured children were going to be treated and were going to be cared for. Despite the risk that they were taking themselves. And one of the images in my brain, I couldn't film anyone's face, of course, because I would be putting them at great risk if their identity would be concealed. So I was filming the hands of these two amazing women as they were stitching up this boy's head without anesthesia, without it was really like a needle and thread. But just seeing their hands, gently and swiftly and skillfully stitching this boy's head back together, and making sure that he was going to be treated and that he would still have a chance of having a future as a whole and healthy child. That's just one of the many examples of incredible resistance that I have encountered. I was at a wedding in Darfur years ago. We were in a rebel-held area that had been just bombed to smithereens by government Antonov airplanes, and the airplanes returned earlier that day. People were terrified that the bombing campaign was going to begin again, but yet they insisted on having that wedding that night. And that wedding and the dancing and the singing and the celebrating, that was a form of resistance. That was a way of people in that village saying to the government of Sudan, you cannot make us disappear. You cannot erase us. We are going to continue to be here. We will celebrate. We will get married. We will have children. So there's so many incredible examples of the form of resistance that I'm trying to document and trying to amplify. In terms of what people can do to get involved, I'm always reluctant to try to give a prescriptive like ABC to-do list because I think that there's, you know, it will always fall, it will always be overly simplistic given the nature of what we're facing in our world. I think the main thing I would do, I mean, we've talked about sort of shifts in how things are perceived. I think we need massive paradigm shifts. And the only starting point I see to that is all of us beginning to ask the question of how am I involved in the injustices that are being perpetrated in the world, and whether we're choosing to be and whether we want to be, we are involved. And until we begin to look at our own power and privilege that we might have been born into in some ways or you know, access in different ways, I think for many people, at least, I can't say this is true for everyone, for many people, the starting place is asking ourselves, you know, what are the, you know, if we're in a position of privilege, what are the systems in place that have privileged us, and how can I work in solidarity with folks to dismantle those systems and work in partnership and in alliance with folks to rebuild those systems with ones that are based with more equity and more true justice. For folks who are already in the position of being on the receiving end of that and, you know, and are not in the position of power where power and privilege has privileged them in any way, then, you know, I think a lot of those folks are already doing the work because in many ways just living and breathing and continuing to survive under those conditions already in many ways is a form of resistance. And I think it's about then linking those struggles together, linking all the different struggles together to look at the bigger picture and find out how we can struggle with each other to really create that paradigm shift.
That's really beautiful. Thank you. Thank you for that. And thank you for being on the show, and thank you very much for listening. I would love to have you back sometime and just talk about, like, the whole time, just about examples like you just gave. That would be really fun if you would like that.
Oh, I would love that. Yeah, Derek, I'd be happy. I'll be on anytime you like.
Okay, great. Anyway, thank you. Thank you for being on, and thank you very much for listening. My guest today has been Jen Marlow. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. Thank you very much.